attacked humans because they were in animals, animal coronaviruses. And every once in a while, there becomes a situation where an animal coronavirus gets access to a human population. And now this is a new virus for humanity. And that's the challenge, because none of us have ever seen this virus before. None of us have immunity to this virus. And this becomes a new challenge for every human being on this planet. This is not the first time this has happened. In 2003, there was an outbreak of an animal coronavirus that made the jump into humans called SARS. And that spread to a couple of countries and a couple of different cities. But then it sort of fizzled out for a variety of reasons. A couple years ago, there was another coronavirus that made the jump called MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Virus. And that is actually an outbreak that's still going on, but it really kind of hasn't gone viral, if you will allow me the term. This one is different. This situation is very different. And the name of this virus currently, and this is probably going to be the name that stays, is SARS-CoV-2. Because it is highly related to the virus that caused SARS back in 2003, which is designated SARS-CoV-1, they've decided to call this virus SARS-CoV-2, coronavirus 2. The disease that it causes is coronavirus disease, identified in 2019, so it has the name COVID-19. As best we know, the first report of this virus came out on New Year's Eve in 2019, when approximately five individuals in a household in Hubei province, Wuhan, China, were diagnosed with severe pneumonia. And it wasn't clear, it wasn't the flu. It wasn't the obvious flares. Nobody knew what it was. What is important to note, actually, about that initial outbreak is that only one of the people in that house had been to the market. The other people in the house hadn't been and probably got it from the first person. So from New Year's Eve, we already had the clue that this virus, you didn't need contact at the animal market to get this virus. You could get it from someone else who had this virus. What I can tell you also, because this information was released from the Chinese CDC, they did a survey and they reported this in a letter to the Journal of American Medical Association, is the characteristics of 44,000 people that they sort of got information on in China who got this disease. And I should mention to you that, as I said, the first report was New Year's Eve. Within 30 days, that virus was in every province in China. We should remember that, right? So I think that gives us some pause and some clue about what's happening here. Within 30 days, that virus was everywhere. 45,000 people, more have gotten it now, but at the time of that report, 45,000 people were sort of studied and reported. And the vast, vast majority of these people had mild symptoms. Almost like human coronavirus. Upper respiratory, cold, some mucus production, but did okay. Some individuals go on from there to develop more severe symptoms because the infection goes from the upper airways into their lungs and causes a pneumonia. And those people develop severe infections. But, you know, that was on the order of you know, 5 to 10%. A few more individuals will then go on further and get very severe infections, and a few more will then die. In total, out of those 44,000, the Chinese reported about a 2% fatality rate. So it's about 2,000 people who they reported died from it. One of the things that's remarkable about sort of the total numbers is if you look at the percentage of people who got it under the age of 10, it was less than 1% out of that 45,000. So our understanding currently is that children either don't get this, or they get this, but they don't get sick from it. And we really don't truly understand the difference right now, though I think we're going to probably start seeing evidence that it's the latter and not the former, but we don't know for sure. If you look at the people who got sick, 80% of them were basically, you know, working age between the ages of like 15 and 60, let's say. So this hits young people, it hits them hard, but they're not the ones dying of it. Children either don't get it or don't get symptomatic from it. Young adults get it, and they'll get sick from it, but they're not really the ones dying. The people who get this and die from it are the elderly. The elderly, and then those with chronic medical conditions. And I think this is what we're starting to see play out in our community.
The next question is, in your opinion, who should get tested?
Yeah, so testing is a whole story in itself. And I actually do want to say a couple of things about this because I am extremely proud to be a resident of this community, this city, this county, and this state. One of the questions that I've gotten before is, why did this happen here? And the answer, which I think the governor alluded to in a news conference earlier today, is we're the ones who found out about it first. This is happening everywhere. But we have the best public health infrastructure, I would say, in the country, and we were able to get on top of this. So the issue with testing is you can't know it's happening unless you test for it. And initially, the capacity for testing was limited because every sample that was suspected had to go to Atlanta, to the Centers for Disease Control for testing. And their turnaround time just wasn't quick enough. So the first patient who was diagnosed in Washington State. He went to a clinic in Everett. He had not been to the market. He had not been in contact with anyone sick. He had been in Wuhan province. He had seen the news, felt himself getting sick, went into a provider to get checked out. That sample had to go to the CDC and get tested and come back, and that's when he found out he was positive. Testing was limited until about last week when better tests were sent out to the different state labs, and particularly in Washington State, we started to do our own testing. But really, the game changer was this past Monday, because this past Monday, testing came online at the University of Washington. And their capacity to do tests is now going to exponentially increase the number of tests that are going to be done. So there's something I want all parents to know about this. Next week, you're going to hear about a whole lot more infections. And it's not because there all of a sudden was more. We just now have the capacity to test for it. And right now, to my knowledge, the University of Washington lab is the only lab in the country that is doing this test outside of the CDC and the designated state labs, which have low capacity to do it. So hopefully that technology is going to be transferred and the other sort of academic labs around the country will be ramping theirs up in preparation. But we are going to catch up, and we are going to catch up fast. And you're going to hear about it. And it's going to look dramatic, but keep in mind, the stuff you're going to hear about in the next week is transmission that happened like 3 weeks ago. We're just finding out about it. So the question of who should get tested right now, because testing is limited, if you go to the public health website, they're being very prescriptive about it. And even in hospitals, we're being limited about it. But I think those criteria are going to expand as the testing capacity expands over the next couple of weeks. So I would refer people to the public health website. Right now, they don't want people coming to emergency departments and doctor's offices if they're sick and mildly sick and they think they have this because they might spread it there. They'd rather them sort of wait at home. But the frustrating thing about that as a parent and a community member is, well, then how do I know what's going on? And you just want me to wait till I get too sick and then go to the emergency department. And I can understand the frustration, but I think that's going to be temporary.
Thank you. So the next question is related, and you kind of answered it, but as far as testing, so do healthcare professionals have enough testing kits, and what is the turnaround time for the test?
So no, we don't have enough testing kits, but we're getting there. And the rank order is really going to be, you know, right now, I can tell you sort of what's happening in Harborview and patients we're seeing in Harborview is, you know, people that we know that were exposed to the cases that we know, right? So people who are in sort of the life care circle in Kirkland, family members or friends of those people, you know, of employees, et cetera, the circle sort of goes from there. There's other exposures at other hospitals that have nothing to do with life care. And there's sort of circles of exposure there too. So that's where the priority is going for testing. As the case at Harborview last week, there are exposed healthcare workers at Harborview. They have been sort of prioritized for testing. And then new patients who are coming in with compatible syndromes are being tested. So it's starting there in a very targeted way, and I'm pretty sure you're going to see that expand out.
How long can children and other healthy adults be carriers of the coronavirus, especially in relation to children being around grandparents or those with pre-existing conditions?
That was a great question. Nobody knows. Nobody knows for sure. And as I said, you know, I find it very hard to believe that children simply can't get this infection. I find it much more likely that they are part of the transmission cycle, but the silent part of the cycle. So they won't really look sick, but the people they give it to could get very sick, depending on who those people are. So I worry particularly about, you know, children or sick children's interactions with grandparents, parents with chronic medical conditions, other people in the community. I think those kinds of interactions are really where we can make a huge difference in seeing the transmission then have outcomes on health. Children transmitting it to other children, where I don't know that we're going to notice that happening. But what we'll notice is then it gets to people who are susceptible.
All right, the next few questions have to do specifically with just the virus and how it survives and things like that. So how long can the virus live on surfaces, and how does that compare with other viruses?
Yeah, that's a great question. I also don't think we know the answer to this. Maybe, in fact, the information. So maybe we have maybe some of the better information on that with influenza, because we have a lot of experience with influenza. And so influenza can survive on surfaces. It can survive for a number of hours, maybe even a day or two. People can get it from touching those surfaces. But really, by and large, influenza is transmitted from someone else who has influenza. So that kind of transmission can occur, but you're not really going to solve an influenza problem by constantly bleaching everything in your house or your school. So in my mind, I don't know that I would think about this virus any differently. I'm sure at some level it can. Our infection control practices at Harborview are based on that presumption. We really are very careful about touching anything that's in the room of a patient that has diagnosed coronavirus or even suspected coronavirus. And all of that gets sort of thrown away because we don't want to take any chances.
Does the virus live on clothing and fabric? And is it worthwhile to wear gloves to protect yourself?
I think in the healthcare setting, that's definitely the strategy, and we do that for many different situations. It's not just coronavirus. I debate the feasibility of that in the household because, you know, if your child is ill and, you know, pouring snot, it's a challenge to just keep away from that while also providing care for your child, right? I mean, I think once you're in the household, it becomes very difficult. Probably what's more efficient is to just keep distance, physical distance, entirely from people who are at risk.
So you may have responded to this, but will bleach kill the virus?
Absolutely. And that is part of our standard infection control practice at Harborview. Bleach plays prominently in that. So what you guys did here for norovirus, great. Your surfaces are clean.
Great. The next question I can answer. Are large group gatherings like the Wedgwood Musical recommended? I'll let you handle that first.
Yeah, actually, maybe I'll I won't comment specifically on the musical, but just to backtrack up to school closing, because as you may have read, North Shore decided to close all their schools and close it for 14 days. I'm sure that wasn't an easy decision for them to make, just as it's not an easy decision for Seattle Public Schools not to close their schools. So, you know, when I read those, I say to myself, well, what is to be accomplished by closing the schools? If there was a virus that was particularly lethal for children, that maybe was passed by other children, I could understand it. We really want to limit interaction of children with other children and isolate them until the whole thing blows over. That's not this virus. Number two, if there was evidence that children were part of the transmission chain, and we think we could break that by closing schools and canceling these kinds of events, that would be the reason to do it. But only if children weren't then just gathering in other ways. If you close schools, but then everybody's down at Doll Park and having a big play date with ice cream, we haven't really solved anything, right? So I think that what you accomplish kind of depends on why you would do it. And then the third thing is all the stuff that Principal Liu mentioned at the beginning, the immense social disruption and economic disruption to the community by virtue of this. Canceling large gatherings, advising people not to. A number of companies have also sort of told people to work from home and eliminated meetings. So I think this kind of social distancing is now coming out and moving forward, which is great to see. Maybe it's probably better done in a staged way rather than all at once. But specific events, it's kind of...
Yeah. And what I will say about the words of the musical is at this time, the district is still recommending that school-sponsored activities continue as scheduled. For example, the high schools, middle schools are continuing athletic events, other school events such as plays at the high school level. And so we are going to continue with the musical performances scheduled for this weekend. And I will be sending out communications to all the Wedgwood families just about some things to keep in mind as far as if you are exhibiting any symptoms or you are sick, then you should not attend the performances, as well as if you have underlying health conditions or are over the age of 60. So it's a tough balance because we have students and staff and parent volunteers that have worked for a long period of time for the musical this weekend. And we also want to keep people safe, and that can be a very difficult balance, especially since the district, the recommendation from the health department is that we still don't need to cancel school evening and after school activities at this time. But just know that things can change quickly, and I will let the community know if there's any other changes that will happen. All right, the next question is it safe to travel by airline domestically if things stay the same, and how does that get impacted if things get worse?
Yeah, so I think this is an evolving area. I can tell you that there was actually a professional meeting I was going to go to in 2 weeks that I bowed out of because I knew by virtue of having worked at Harborview that I may have been exposed, and I would have been in that incubation period when I went, and I just didn't feel that was prudent. Different organizations are coming out with specific recommendations, including companies like Amazon, Seattle Children's Hospital. I've heard a number of them over the last couple of days. Honestly, I think that's probably a good idea. I think if you're here, and this is where it seems like a lot of the action is, maybe we should just stick around here and not travel to other parts of the country. Having said that, I think it's probably in a lot of other parts of the country too, and they just don't know it yet because they can't test the way that we can. And once they do, they'll find out.
Okay. Next question, do you and your colleagues have enough protective equipment, such as masks and shields, and how do medical professionals protect themselves?
I really appreciate that question. Whoever asked that, thank you very much. The short very direct answer is no, we do not. We do not have enough equipment. It is an issue. It is an issue at Harborview. It is an issue at all the UW-affiliated hospitals, Valley, Northwest, UWC. It is an issue at the other hospitals as well, including the ones that have already seen the patients, Everett, Highline. And it's for many reasons. But I think the practical consequences of this are, if we don't have enough protective equipment, it will be prioritized for this, and then it's actually not available for other infectious diseases and risks. And I'll give you one very specific example. So there's been a lot in the news about these N95 masks that are really sort of, for the most part, limited in utility to the healthcare setting. When you go to the pediatrician or the doctor's office and you have a cold, they make you put on those little surgical masks, right, to sort of prevent you from coughing and sneezing on other people, but they don't make you wear an N95. So there's really not a lot of utility for that kind of mask in the community, but there's a lot of utility for that kind of mask in the hospital. For example, it's one of the main ways we protect against tuberculosis. So if there's not enough of those masks and we're prioritizing them for COVID-19 patients, we actually can't take care of tuberculosis patients in a safe way. So these are the kinds of decisions and discussions that are happening in the hospitals in the area, clinics as well. And so, you know, I want to specifically say something to people in the community that have these masks at home, because I understand why you would want to have them. The recommendation from public health, which I think makes sense, is if you're going to have any masks at home, have a couple surgical masks at home, like the ones you have at the doctor's office, because if you get sick and you put those on, you are protecting the other people around you from you. There's really not a lot of utility for you having N95s at home. And I'll tell you why. Because they're really uncomfortable. And what happens is when you have them on and you're walking around and you're constantly fidgeting with your face and touching your eyes and touching your, you've just inoculated yourself with like everything that was on your finger. Probably more than if you hadn't been wearing the mask. So in the healthcare setting, we actually go through a lot of training. And we limit the amount of time we have those on to just the specific interaction with the patients because they're really uncomfortable. And we could put ourselves at risk as much as we could protect ourselves when we're using them. So here's my one request for tonight. If you have a lot of these masks at home, keep a box for yourself, but take the rest of them and donate them to a first responder. Take them to the firehouse. Take them to the clinic. Drop them off at Harborview. Trust me, we're going to need them in the next couple of weeks more than you will. And keep a little bit for yourself in case you get sick, but you don't need a whole bunch of boxes.
Thank you. Next question. What was the role of the Seattle flu study in catching the spread of the coronavirus? We'll start with that one. This is a few-part question.
That's a good question. This was also covered in the Seattle Times. What I'll say is the first patient who was diagnosed mid-January was diagnosed in Everett, and samples were sent to the CDC. And I told you that testing was very limited at that time. There were a number of people that he interacted with who were suspects, and those people were actually followed and tested also at the CDC. About 60 or 70 tests were done for a number of weeks, and all of them were negative. And I think we sort of had this sense of false confidence that things were okay. But the second person who was diagnosed was a teenager in Snohomish County, a high school student. And that high school student was diagnosed through the Seattle flu study. And I think that was a real wake-up call that, no, it wasn't just this person in Everett, and this person in Snohomish County had no interaction with being in China or, you know, the person who was first diagnosed. So the sense was between January and late February, there's no connection between these people, and there are 60 or 70 people that were tested at the CDC and negative, but the flu study is picking this up, that it's probably out in the community, and it was a big wake-up call.
Okay. The next part of this question is, what has been your experience with the CDC and access to federal coronavirus testing?
Well, so I mostly covered that. I think what's going to happen now is that we are going to like I said, over the next week, you're just going to hear about a whole lot more cases. And that's because the UW is going to be testing, at probably about 10 times the rate of what the CDC and the state lab were doing. Okay.
You've already talked about how undiscovered it is and indications that it's... if you want to speak a little more maybe about indications that it's more dangerous than the seasonal flu.
Yeah, I think that's something that's come up is, the flu kills more people. Okay. So the flu has killed 18,000 people in the United States this year. It's caused over 30 million infections. This was news to me. I learned this the other day, that in the state of Washington, there have been no less than 50 outbreaks of influenza at long-term care facilities like LifeCare. So I would say just our general practice of protecting the vulnerable in our communities is not great if this is what's happening with influenza, right? But maybe we've gotten a little bit complacent to influenza because it's just there all the time. We have a vaccine that's partially effective. We have, we have drugs that are reasonably effective. And so the analogy is there, but it's not perfect. As I mentioned, this is new. Young people are getting it. Young people can die from it. They can also die from the flu, but at a lower rate. The mortality rate, again, just overall from what's been described in China, is higher. So if nobody knows for sure, but we're talking about 2% or 3%. Doesn't sound like a lot, but the mortality rate for influenza in this country is under 0.5%. So, we're talking about 50 times more lethal, if you want to use that term. So it's different in important ways.
So what precautions should asthmatic students or those with asthma take?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I have a son who's in school here who has asthma. I have asthma. And I know there's a lot of kids who do. And I think this is a conversation that we really need to have, which is, we talk about children like they're all sort of the same, and we talk about the elderly and the vulnerable like they're a different box, but there are vulnerable children. So there are children that have problems with their immune system or problems with their lungs. And so I think the asthma question is a very good one. I have to say my own, again, as a parent and as a professional, I feel like what I'm going to do is I'm just going to watch my kid. I know my kid. I know what he looks like when he gets an asthma flare. And I know how to treat him, and I know what makes him better. And if something looks different, I'm going to say something sooner rather than later. Maybe more so than before this thing came along. I'm not sure I can really do much more than that right now.
And the last of the submitted questions so far is, and you've spoken to this a little bit, but is it possible for a person to carry coronavirus, infect others, and never get sick?
I guess we're saying that may be what children are doing in this epidemic. That may be actually their role in this, is that it's spreading in these networks in the community unnoticed, maybe through children and young adults who are mildly symptomatic. We just don't know.
Okay. So now I would like to open it up to anyone else who has any questions. Or if there's any questions that have been submitted on Facebook.
That's a great question. So she asked me to clarify who should be tested and where they should go. So I'm not sure what the King County Public Health website says right now, but I can tell you the University of Washington, on their website, they have instructions for providers in the community to submit their tests. And they have instructions on how to collect the specimen, how to label it, and how to send it to the University of Washington so they can do the testing. I'll tell you right now, this is all literally as of Monday when that test came online. And the priority is really to kind of work on the hospitalized patients right now, because we don't really even have a good sense of all the patients in the hospital today in Puget Sound, who has this thing. We don't even know that. And maybe they were admitted for a different reason, but they picked it up in the community and they have it in the hospital. So there are priority populations that they're going to test. And then they're going to be testing outpatients, I think. I'm not exactly sure, but they have to sort of decide that. In a week or two, when the testing, I think, really sort of like goes through the roof, I think anybody who wants to get tested probably will get tested. But that's not the case right now. The other thing I can mention is that the Seattle flu study is going to have a part in this. So yesterday, the Gates Foundation announced $100 million of funding for COVID-19, and some fraction of those funds are going straight to the flu study to fund expansion of their testing capacity in the community. Those of you who are in the flu study know that they're testing for it for research purposes, but because they're a research study, they can't return results. So there's also an ongoing conversation with the state of Washington and the CDC about using the flu study, changing the flu study so it actually is an arm of this surveillance capacity, and to send results back. And that'll offload the University of Washington. So, I mean, this is sort of just real time happening, and it's kind of remarkable to be in a place where this is possible, because it's not other parts of the country that have access to this yet.
In regards to testing right now, what is the turnaround time? I'm sure the revenue is a lot more requests and also the ramping up their fleet, but you expect the turnaround to get shorter or longer based on that. And then one more same question. Is there plans for other facilities or hospitals to be able to test on site?
Okay, so there's two questions. What is the number one, what's the turnaround time for testing? And the, number two, is there plans for other testing sites to come online to expand capacity? So I can tell you now that the turnaround time for tests being done on patients at Harborview Medical Center is probably about a day. And it'll probably get even faster as they just keep doing more tests. I honestly don't know the turnaround time for tests if you're in the community. And I would imagine some of those tests are going to the CDC. Some of those tests are going to the state lab. So it's going to be longer. It's kind of my set. I honestly don't know. Are other sites coming online? So the Department of Health in the state of Washington is talking to commercial vendors, is my understanding. I would imagine like LabCorp, things like that, to provide this test. But to my knowledge, that hasn't happened yet. And I don't know of any other actors in this area within the state of Washington.
Yes. I'm here on behalf of the parents with this internet, so knows my face. Anyway, going back to the asthma question, so like with your son with the asthma, is there, and if a child with asthma is going through a rough period, should they come to school or should they stay home?
So the question was, if a child with asthma is having a rough period, should they come to school or stay home with parents? And I guess implied in the question is, if they're already sort of, their lungs have already got one hand tied behind their back, and they get exposed to this, is that going to sort of really do them harm? That's just hard to know. I mean, honestly, I would say if a kid's having a hard time with that, they should just stay home anyway until they're well enough to come to school. They are probably going to get set back if they pick up another virus anyway. I mean, this happens to my son. It feels like he's just getting over the last one, and then he gets the next one. And he's at school for like a day in between. Mm-hmm. So I don't expect anything to be different about this. Really, my sense from sort of looking at the reports coming out of China, I'm not that worried about children as a group. I worry a little bit about really sick children. But there's nothing that came out about children with medical conditions. But we really don't know. I'm hoping we'll get more detail from China over the coming weeks, because it would be great to have that level of detail.
I'm curious of people's ability to generate resistance to this, like other strains that you have to get lost in the body testing. I'm curious about them coming out for next fall and come back again.
Yeah.
Picked it up here, maybe it's a lot of mosquitoes, but has
Yeah, so the question is about can you develop immunity to this? And I think the broad answer to this is probably. And this is kind of what happens with pandemics. So some of you may remember in 2009, the flu H1N1. So that was kind of an analogous situation because that was a new influenza that we hadn't seen before. And it sort of made its way across the world in the same kind of way that this virus is doing. And a lot of people got sick. But then the second wave that came around afterwards wasn't so bad. And it's because most people had been exposed to it the first time around, and enough people had developed at least partial immunity to it that it kind of blunted the effect the second time it came around. And I think that's what you're reading, is that people are expecting this will behave the same way. This first time around, because it's really new, is going to be the worst. And then we don't really know what will happen. It might just burn out. I mean, that's kind of what happened to SARS. Or it may stick around with us in various ways, like H1N1 has. But it won't be as bad as it was the first time. Question was, does it depend on climate? I guess not, because it's been detected on every continent as of today, except Antarctica. It's probably just because there's not a lot of people there. There's no reason it can't be there, too. Okay.
Other questions from Facebook?
I do have some Facebook questions, so I'm going to help them, because some of these kind of touched on, but I'm going to ask them anyway.
Sure.
And I also want to know that the parent community is incredibly grateful that you are here at Lawrenceville and really good about this talk. For children with chronic medical conditions, how concerned should we be about possible exposure at school if kids are non-symptomatic?
Yeah, I mean, I think my default position is children who have this basically are asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic. You are not going to be able to tell the difference between a child who has a runny nose from a cold and this. That is my sense from looking at what's coming out of China. They just don't get that sick.
Another question is, how worried should I be about my 8-year-old parents? Should I keep my children away from visiting them?
Yes.
So, yeah, the question was, how worried should someone be about elderly parents, especially those over 80, and should they keep their children away from those elderly grandparents?
Yes. That's the first social distancing I would do. We just don't know if children have it, when they have it, and the last thing we want is for them to give it to the vulnerable people that are the dearest to us in our communities and in our lives, really. I think that is one of the hard lessons we're learning from life care. That is the population we want to keep the farthest away from anyone who might have this.
Is there a follow-up question?
Yeah. I think it was the ERE that we learned a lot as far as where it skyrockets. Same thing that you said, is there a part of the curve where it skyrockets?
Yeah, so one of the reasons you're hearing that, and I just pulled this up. Oh, yeah, let me.
So the question is there a certain age level where just the severity skyrockets and What's other information, especially about the ages of people that get this and the severity?
Yeah, so the reason that number is being thrown out there is because the report that came out from the Chinese CDC last week or 2 weeks ago quoted a 2% fatality rate overall. But if you just looked at people over the age of 80 who got this, it was 15%.
I'm considered elderly, and I've been around these kids for 3 months. And actually, if my grandchildren, if they need help, I'm the one who takes care of them. And I think that's quite common with a lot of grandparents, that they're the ones that need childcare when the parents have to stay with the parents.
So the question was about grandparents keeping distance from children when they're actually the providers. The surrogate providers on parents at work. This is one of these really sort of, I think, social aspects of this disease and where sort of some of the implications for school closings and stuff can also have an impact. I think that's a really tricky situation. I will tell you personally, neither my wife's parents nor my parents live in this community, but we have them come in frequently when we need their help and we're in a crunch. And as some of you may know, we are in a real crunch right now. And we did not tell them. And we told them to stay away. This is a hard decision.
Since we are anticipating an increase in cases because of access to testing, any idea when that number would level off? I assume this question is, can you anticipate when we start to see the decline?
So the question is really about when will we see the peak of the epidemic. So there's a couple of parts to that answer. First of all, we kind of don't even know where we are because we haven't tested enough. I don't know if you've seen these graphs that they do for influenza, where like week by week, they'll sort of track out influenza by state or within the country. And you get, the peak is always obvious in retrospect, because what happens is as they map out what's happening week by week, you look back and you're like, oh, it's coming down. The peak was 3 weeks ago or a month ago, but you don't really sort of know it when it's happening. So there's no graph for that right now. We don't even have enough data to even start making the first point on that graph. So we need to do that first, and then we need to graph it, and then we need to see where it goes. But having said that, what I can tell you is, you know, the Chinese, they did not have a vaccine. They did not have a drug. What they did was social distancing on a level we are probably not going to achieve, and we're not going to do it the way they did it, but they have seen the peak. They are well on their way down from the peak, and it's very obvious that they've been able to get this under control with significant social distancing efforts. That is obvious. So I think one of my goals is to really sort of have us think critically. You know, how can we achieve that level of success knowing that we are fundamentally a different country with a different set of norms, a different set of cultural backgrounds, values, politics, but we need the same outcome. We need to see that peak, and we need to see it in our rearview mirror.
Another question about the vaccine. Sensitivity and specificity wise.
Okay. So the question is about how accurate is the testing? So there's a couple of questions there. You know, a test is good if it picks up everybody who has the problem that you're looking for, and it doesn't pick up anybody who you know doesn't have the problem. And that's the question about sensitivity and specificity. I would say this is a little new. The way the test is built, just kind of like the molecular biology of it, it seems like it's well-reasoned and it works reasonably well. It's definitely not perfect. There have been some false negatives reported. You might have read about the case in California at the University of California, Davis, where someone tested negative and then she tested positive. But in between there, she had exposed a number of people. So it's clearly not a perfect test. But it's the test we have right now. Yes? Yeah, so that's a great question. So the question was about a scientist named Trevor Bedford at the Fred Hutchinson, who is actually part of the flu study. And one of the things he did that I think people have really picked up on, and it was covered pretty aggressively in the New York Times and Washington Post, is he took the sequence from the patient who came out of the flu study, which was a month or more separated from the first patient who was diagnosed in Everett. Because the question at the time was, wow, there's been like a month or 6 weeks between this. Is it possible that it's another virus that came from China? Was it connected to the first one from Everett? And he was able to connect it directly to the first patient, which means that it had been spreading in the community almost like a wildfire under the brush that you can't see until it pops up for the better part of a month. And so using that information, he estimated how many people might actually be out there and infected. And the number he came to was something like 500 or 1,000. You know, I don't have any reason to doubt that estimate. But as I said, how many of those are children and they're asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic? And then how many of those are residents at Life Care for whom this infection can be fatal? That we don't know.
So I had mentioned that things can happen quickly. So I was just handed a message that just came out that the school district is now canceling all school events that don't happen during the school day. And so, therefore, the musical is going to be postponed to a later date. I'm going to send something out to all Wedgwood families so they're aware in case they're not live streaming this right now or in person. And we'll keep you updated on the plans. We'll honor tickets already purchased, so please hold on to them. And there is no tech rehearsal tomorrow. We recognize the impact that this has on all the students and all the people who have been preparing for this for months. But again, this is because the school district has now canceled all out-of-school events. So,
that's disappointing.
Yes. Are there any other questions?
The question is, one of the things we're trying to avoid here is panic and overreaction, and is anything being done to counter that? And I would say, yes, that's why I'm here. So please take these messages and spread them with your friends, with your community, and if this is useful to, you know, other schools, I'm happy to do some version of this again. The situation is evolving rapidly. I think the other thing that will help, you know, panic and overreaction is to know that scientists are working really hard on this, like right in your backyard. The Seattle flu study is going to be, I think, at the center of the national response to this, because we are going to understand what's happening in our community very quickly, more quickly than had this thing landed first anywhere else. There is a new drug being investigated for this infection, and that trial starts, you know, any day now. There's a vaccine that's going to be evaluated, and those trials are happening here in Seattle at our affiliated hospitals. So we're not sitting back and, you know, waiting for this thing to wash over us. I think one of the things that helps panic and overreaction is to know that, you know, you can do something. You can do something in the fight. I mean, I feel very privileged that, you know, I'm at the hospital full of great professionals that don't blink an eye when you tell them there's a new pandemic, because they've just been around the block so many times and seen so many things come their way. We're in this area where we have so many great resources. And I feel like this community is just like not an overreacting community. I don't know, maybe it's a Pacific Northwest thing. So that's great. If that's sort of the nature of our DNA, then great. That's going to really work to our advantage. So then let's work together to make logical choices for our communities. Social distancing from our elders, the vulnerable, and then sort of being cognizant about when people are sick and then when they're in gatherings, canceling gatherings as painful as it can be. I think we're going to make a difference. I really do.
How are you guys addressing that with the kids? Did it make sense to have them without, you know, panting them, but little kids are just always, you know, touching their faces?
Yeah, so the question was, how are we addressing the coronavirus, the outbreak, with our students and with kids? I can say that our staff are spending a lot of time talking with kids, and obviously in a very age-appropriate way, just about great preventative measures like hand washing, covering coughs and sneezes, washing your hands after you cough and sneeze, after you use a tissue. There's also a number of online resources that have been created that are available to our staff that we're showing to students. like videos. NPR had released a comic that is kind of talks about the coronavirus in a in an appropriate way for our third through fifth grade students, and so that has been shared as well. But I think, you know, to speak with what I've observed with our students is, yes, it is something they're talking about, but they're also kids. And so we're seeing them, you know, still talk about other things that are happening, their interests, enjoying, you know, things happening in class, and of course, enjoying recess time and time with their friends. And so kids are very resilient and are moving on very quickly to lots of things that they're usually concerned about. So,
Two last questions. You said that China did not have a drug. Do we have a drug? And the second one is fever a hallmark symptom? Can we have the flu and not have a fever?
Yeah, so the first question was, I said China did not have a drug, and the question was, do we have a drug? No, we don't have a drug that works, but we have a drug that's being studied to see if it works, and the place it's being studied is here, because we right now have the most number of cases. It will probably be studied other places in the country too, but it'll be a while before we know if it works or not for this particular problem. The second question was, is fever a hallmark of this? It's a good question because, you know, implicit in that is how do I tell the difference between the flu and COVID-19? And it can be very difficult.
Or a cold.
And so I think, you know, what is being recommended from public health, and it's actually kind of recommended, actually kind of reported with the first patient, is having a fever is a hallmark of this. Muscle aches, body pain, not different from what you would have with the flu. What's different about this is effectively then some patients go on to develop a pneumonia. So that's what you're reading when you see the list of things include cough and shortness of breath. You know, it's not necessarily those things in isolation, but effective, what's happening kind of biologically is the infection is moving down in the lungs and the person is developing a pneumonia, which can happen in influenza too, but not as commonly as it's happening with COVID.
I heard this from someone today at work, and they were saying that symptoms of corona is more of a dry cough versus, you know, like a congestion. Is that before?
So the question was, is the dry cough more indicative of coronavirus rather than a gurgly cough?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thank you so much for everyone who attended. Thank you for those who are live streaming. I hope this was very informative. I think that's one of the ways that we can move calmly through this and just staying informed to think about what we can do as a community to keep each other safe. Thank you, Dr. Sasadri, for your time. And we'll be communicating more with family. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.